Welcome to another special episode of Zaps to the Past. This week, we've got an Ask the Podcast. We are going to answer questions that have been put to us by our patrons. They have asked us stuff. We must answer them. And also, as well, it allows us to put something out while work is still getting in the way of stuff. So, you know, like I said last week, we don't want to leave you in the lurch. But next week, we will be back. With the starting February 1990. But for this week, yeah, we're going to answer some questions. We've got a whole range of questions that have been asked. Are you looking forward to these questions, Graham?
Yes, I always look forward to questions.
He does as well. He really does. Sometimes he just rings me. He's like, ask me a question. I'm looking forward to it. I'm like, oh, Graham, it's 2 a.m.
It's always nice to get so interaction from our amazing patrons. So yeah.
The question you normally get to that point is, why are you ringing me at 2 a.m?
Yeah, stop ringing me.
not a question. I have to ask you a question. Why are you doing this anyway? Just before we get going, though, a couple of weeks back, we did the shout out. Apologies, I missed Ben Granville because he's been with us for a while. I know, because of the way the patron lists them.
Make your excuses, you fool.
Well, I did, but sorry, I'm very, very sorry, Ben. If you're wondering where you were, it's my fault, and I take full responsibility. But you know, I'm very sorry. But just putting it out there now, sort of thing. Ben Granville is one of our awesome patrons, and so there you go. So he's supporting the show, and he's ace.
Lovely special mention. He's one of our patrons, and there you go. Sorry, Ben. I apologize on Adrian's behalf.
I've just apologized.
He blatantly forgot to add you to the proper list.
I can tell you why. It's because Ben supported us with donations. We've mentioned Ben a couple of times. He's in the list higher up, so the new ones just get at the bottom of the list. So when new people join and Ben signed up, he was already.
Excuses. Cover yourself in lard and run around your garden.
Absolutely,
again.
I will. I'll be getting those eggs on a chain again out and punishing myself positively. So apologies for that, Ben. Effusive apologies. But thank you. Thank you for supporting us. You are cool.
Yay.
Right, let's get on with the questions.
Do it.
First one. Photon Storm asks...
Hello, Photon Storm.
How many episodes in advance do you record? Well, this should answer that question, isn't it? Because here we are recording stuff to fill in the blanks when we've got work
in the way. Back in the day, we used to record 2 episodes every time we recorded. And in the end, it became too much. It became too much to try and cram all the games in. And we couldn't give the games proper justice as well. And everything else. So we decided to change the format of that. So now we just kind of, and plus also the production techniques that I use dramatically improved over time as I got better at it. So we just kind of do a week in a bag, don't we? We don't even work 1 week ahead, are we? It's just, you know, we record on the Thursday and then it's released the following week. So a week ahead, I guess, is that?
Yeah, we're a week ahead, but sometimes that can lead to...
Sometimes it rolls a bit, yeah.
Yeah, so we have to do the Back to the Past specials and things like that, but we kind of have them in the back pocket that we can always roll out, or we do a Battle of the Pilots or something like that, but, you know, so there you go. We're a fly-by-the-seat-of-our-pants kind of production, which is what it is. Set Me Guy, I presume that's how you pronounce it, asks, on the topic of the podcast recordings, are most of your recordings done via something like Zoom or Teams, or are you both in the same room? And if not, live with Adrian and Graham, same room, why not? Well, we don't live with each other.
No, we don't live in the same... We don't even live in the same place.
No, we're not even in the same town anymore.
No, and we just to, you know, for the techno mods out there and to give it probably a plug that maybe they deserve, I don't know. We use Riverside FM to record our podcasts, which is an excellent tool for that. And so we don't use Zoom or Teams, God forbid.
We did used to. When we first started, we used Zoom.
The Zoom was for the video, but we always recorded the audio. We used to record...
Separately, didn't
you
we?
You used to record... Yeah, I recorded it on my end using Audition. You'd record it on...
Audacity,
and then AD would send me his, and AD had to emit a beep at the beginning of every recording for sound.
So a really loud beep. Like the clapperboard clap, innit?
It was loud enough so I could hear it over my headphones on my microphone, so that I could then synchronize that beep when we put the recordings together. Mercifully, we then discovered that there were tools designed to change that. And that was actually, remember what the, and just as, you know, if you're wondering why all of this shenanigans, why we don't just go to somebody's house and record, partly because it's easy to do it this way, but also this was born from during lockdown. And yes, so we couldn't actually physically be in the same place when we first started recording this. So, and trust me, the technology and the things we use now, so much better than the jury-rigged crazy that we use for this, what would be episode zero and episode one. Goodness me. Yeah, it's we suffered technical issues quite a lot in those early days. Thankfully, we don't really have those anymore.
No, there was one point where there's episodes in the middle somewhere where I recorded an entire episode with my microphone backwards.
Yeah, there is. Yeah,
you can probably go back and listen and see if you can find it. Where I'm like,
there's an episode. There's an episode where I recorded and there was a whistle all the way through my microphone because it wasn't plugged in correctly. So it was like a sound. It was so annoying. As time's gone on, we got better. And you know, we did used to use a different system, but Riverside seems to have provided us with the audio video stuff that we need to do.
Lee Dove asks, love for there to be a reader's choice for a before Zap episode, especially since Lemon 64 makes it easy to find earlier reviews. I've been holding off on this until I could think of a good choice, and I reckon that the Aussie soft version of Journey to the Center of the Earth, released in the UK by CRL as Journey, is an interesting one. We could do that.
Well, there's an option to do that.
Our sort of episode zeros were our choice of games from before Zap, weren't they? We did 1982, 83, 84. So we did do a load of before Zap stuff, but there's probably loads. There's loads we didn't cover.
There's loads of Activision games and stuff in there hidden away out in the backwaters, aren't there? It's an opportunity to do that. We could perhaps create a list and think about, you know, give the patrons or somebody the pickings and see. We'll see. I wouldn't rule that out. It's a good idea.
Yeah, a lot of the good ones were picked up probably on budget re-releases and Zap.
Yes, exactly.
And they did pick up a lot of the sort of, like we've just done Dig Dug. That was released in 1983.
Yeah.
So there are, Zap did review a load of games from that period, re-releases or in those first few issues. But yeah, certainly.
And also, Journey to the Center, sounds boring.
But it's released, and it's got the CRL stink on it.
Yeah, crappy release license, yeah.
So maybe we'll look at Journey. Don't stop believing is all I'll say about that.
I knew you were going to say that. Waiting for the crap Journey pun. He's going to say it. I know he's going to say it.
Absolutely. Oh, had to do it faithfully.
God's sake. Stop, David, Flynn.
David Hearn Writer asks, what do your family, friends, colleagues think about the podcast? I think we're mad.
I think my family think it's, you know, they're really behind it. You know, it's kind of a thing. They look at it as a thing that I do. You know, it's a thing that I do. They don't listen to it, I don't think, or at least I don't think they're that interested in retro games. So it's not really their thing.
No.
Friends and stuff. Well, you know, you've heard one of our oldest friends on the podcast. So you've heard Gary on there. So.
Yeah.
You know, and other, as far as I know, my other friends, my colleagues, you know, they're quite supportive of the podcast. The people that I've listened to it, you know, we get good feedback. So, what about you? Do you get that?
I think there's a lot of it's a bit of incredulity that we're actually playing so many games and doing it and we're putting it out every week.
Yeah,
I think it's like, wow, and on top of work and everything. But yeah, I think generally most people are just like, wow, you do. Okay, cool. That's, when I actually give them some sort of stats and facts, and we've done 150, 60 odd episodes, and we've had this many downloads, and they were like, oh, okay, so it's not just some ropey fly by night thing.
It's normally when they say, how long have you been doing the podcast for? I'm like, a few years.
Yeah, a few years. We've got this many people listening, and we've got this, and they're like, okay.
Yeah, it's a full production behind it. It's not some, you know, we don't just wing it.
Yeah. Although it does sound like that sometimes. He also asked, do you think making criminals play the likes of Lee Enfield, Knight Rider, Alice in Videoland, Intergalactic Cage Match, and Bionic Granny might help reform them? No, it would just make them angrier.
No, it would make them angry, very angry. And I don't think you need to be encouraging. Now, if you watch The Green Mile, they're like, just, you know, keep people calm on there. Yeah. No, that's the plan. You know, you don't want to, you know, unpredictable people do unpredictable things, don't they?
You don't want to give them a weapon and a joystick.
No. You don't know whether that could end up in places that you don't want it to end up.
No, exactly. Lee Dove asks, there's another idea for a podcast episode alongside games that weren't. What about games that, alongside games that weren't, what about games that weren't reviewed in Zap? Yeah, I think.
Okay.
So it's basically games that came out that Zap never reviewed. Candidate number one, Tangled Tales. So we've got a list, haven't we? We've got a list of a few of them that were sort of that were in the Zap years, but never looked up.
Yeah, we started to compile a list, didn't we, of the games that were, because every now and again we come across one and we think, oh, actually, there's no zap entry for that. And there's been some odd ones that you think that probably should have been in there. Why? Yeah.
Transformers by Ocean is the one I always think about. That one was missed. And there was
what we created. Said somewhere we created, like, we started to create a big list of them all, didn't we? And it turned out there was actually quite a few.
Quite a lot.
So yeah, quite a lot there. So we might, you know, we'll probably add them to the list, you know, at some point, maybe.
Yeah, somewhere. ALH2 Retro asks, if you could change or improve one thing about the C64, what would it be?
That's a good question, isn't it? Actually, we answered it in the Discord.
We answered it in the Discord. Oh, in the Discord.
Yeah, and I think just, you know, my take was that there's certain things about the C64 you can't change because it wouldn't have developed since, you know, the machine has difficulties and hindrances and bugs and quirks, and those bugs and quirks and exploits of those are what have led to some amazing graphics and discoveries on the C64, which have led to some real big improvements in how the games work. So sometimes you need a few hurdles to climb over to make the games better. I think, you could say, well, give it more memory, but the C128 was there for that. I think you could probably give it, you know, maybe a slightly faster processor, maybe would have helped a bit. Maybe more than 8 hardware sprites. I don't know, you know, so that you could just, you know, something like that. I don't know. There would be small changes. I don't think you can change, because there's so much about the C64 that is quite quirky, that to change it would be to change that formula, and I think that would be a mistake.
From a programming standpoint, and going back then, this is probably more something you would be able to answer, because I'm not up on the sort of kind of the early stuff. What about the ability to actually multiply and divide, or is that a, instead of having to do that?
Yeah, you could add that to that. You could add
sequentially.
That to that. I mean, yeah, you could. Base. You could add that. That's a limitation of the mathematical capabilities of a 6502 and the way that actually operates. That's a core, you know, 8-bit. Chipset problem.
Right.
It's very difficult to put multiplication logic in and keep it cycle friendly as well. You don't really need to do it, you know. Generally speaking, that kind of thing is, you know, it would be good to have pre-calculation and things like that. So for things that need to zoom and, you know, push things about, but that's CPU grunt, really. That's, you know, that's an up in the megahertz from 1 would be a beneficial, you know.
Yeah. Or 0.93 it is for the PAL one, isn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly. Your vector games would just, you know, look a bit more better. Yeah. They wouldn't jerk around so much and stuff like that. They'd be a bit more like the BBC and Spectrum in that respect. And that might have been a key differentiator. But yeah, I mean, you could change you could add some more of those opcodes in there. There are loads of hidden opcodes in the C64. You could add some of those back in. I don't know. Yeah, maybe some improvement of the maths in there and a bit more, you know, logic behind it. Some people would argue that the basic on the C64 would need changing, because the basic language on the C64 is crap.
It's pretty
really crap. Yeah. It's a really crap implementation of the BASIC as well. So you could have better BASIC. I never really programmed a lot in BASIC, apart from when I was at school on the BBC, and even then I hated it. So that could be improved on. I think if you wanted to do BASIC or put a better version of BASIC in, I know you could buy the more advanced versions, couldn't you, whatever it was called. But no, I stuck to, you know, as soon as I stuck a cartridge in that could do machine code, I was kind of away with that and just learned at it by hacking at it and getting the, you know, Commodore 64 programmer's reference guide. Once you got that, kind of didn't need any of the books. So that's me. What would I improve? I don't know. Maybe, actually, one thing, maybe, after saying all that, maybe this isn't one thing. Just square pixels constantly would be nice, wouldn't it? Just square pixels. Find a better way of doing multicolor, because just widening and everything was always made the C64 games. It gave them a look, but it also, it massively restricted them what the games could look like. So maybe that.
There you go. Lee Dove asks, have you ever thought about what to do with old games collections? Well, part of me is all about, you'll have to pry them from my cold dead hands. I've started doing dostadning or death cleaning so as not to leave a hoard behind for my family to deal with. I'm trying to work out whether to sell or donate to the Powerhouse Museum now or down the road. And have you ever sold something only to regret it later? I've got more games than you, haven't we?
Way more, yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah,
I've got but I've got not got a huge amount. I'm looking at them right now, in fact. I've not got a massive amount of actual physical games these days. And to be fair, like with most things, I'm going digital. So all the old, I don't have any kind of retro collection. The oldest I go back to is PS1, I guess, which I suppose is retro. I have some PS1 and N64 games, not many. And then beyond that, it's just stuff for systems I still have, which I go, that's where I go back to. Anything beyond that is all emulated. I'm not a sort of person who cares about it being cycle accurate to a, you know, real hardware type thing. Yeah. It just doesn't bother me though.
Fair enough.
But yeah, as to what's going to happen to them when they go, I don't know. I'd probably keep them because there's quite a lot of money in there. So pay for my funeral.
Chirpy. Chirpy that. I mean, I've got one sort of storage box with a load of Xbox 360 games in it, loads of them, load of PS3, they're stored in boxes. Now, I don't have the Xbox 360 has long since been retired. It's just sat and it's sat with them. Same as the Xbox One. It very rarely gets powered on. I can't think of the last time it was on, maybe well over a year ago. The PS4 has been getting some recent life because my teenage lad has been playing through a few games on that, Last of Us and things like that, and Bloodborne, Destiny as well, and Bloodborne as well, and things like that. So he's been having a go at that. I had to buy a new PS4 controller, which was an odd experience, because my original Glacier White one, because I've got the Glacier White edition, the Destiny edition of a PS4, which is, you know, ultra rare, maybe. So is it? They made millions of damn things. But I've got that. And again, I've got a few games for that are kind of in a drawer, but retroactive games, as in the old retro games. Oddly, I've got a Sega Mega CD game, which is Soul Feast. Yeah, because the music on them, you could play in an ordinary MP3 player, an ordinary music player, and the music, yeah. I love. I've got that. But that's purely for the music. Everything else, I don't have any old retro games. None. They're all emulated. I don't have any. Yeah. I don't own them. I wouldn't even want to. I did have an original C64, and I have an original Acorn Electron as well. I gave them to a museum, a computer museum, because they were literally sat on a shelf rotting and that. And what's the point in that? They may as well be, you know, utilized in some manner or other.
Yeah.
So other than that, I have literally no retro stuff like that. All emulated. I know I've got the Switch, of course, and already it seems to be collating small boxes of games. And I'm like, how does it happen?
It just does. That's what they're for.
But I've maybe got 5 or 6 real, you know, hardware titles for them. Ridiculously large boxes for tiny little things, then. They could put them in matchboxes and it would still be, though, efficient. Yeah. They need to be in this giant plastic case. But that's it for me, that's it, really. So yeah. I don't have a big collection, nor do I have anything on, you know, digital format, really, that would, you know, that somebody would want. And I'd give it to my lads if they wanted them. But
David Herdwriter asks, given all that power, why do you think some C64 games are just better than their Amiga counterparts? Example, Whizball or Defender of the Crown, perhaps.
Because it's not about power, is it?
No, power doesn't equal, you know, power doesn't equal better. More power. It's like, no. Yeah, but it's the design behind it. And also knowing how to sort of use the machine to its fullest capability, as Cripps and John Hare managed with Whizball. You know, they showed when all the games they did and things like that. Yep. So how well you know the machine is ultimately going to tell, you know, how, you know, the game is going to turn out. It's just simple as that. I think as well, as you get more power, it's more RAM to fill, more things to combine, more colors, everything becomes comprehensively more, you know, exponentially more tricky. Look at modern video games and, you know, to hear like, what did Spider-Man just came out? Spider-Man cost $300 million to make.
Jeez. Wow.
So there's thousands of people working on these titles. Mm. So, you know, you might look at them and go, oh, God, they look incredible. But thousands of people, hundreds of people. It's like managing that is a nightmare. So as you get more power and a bigger team, managing everyone in that team to make everything, it just doesn't always sort of, you know, just because the machine is more powerful doesn't mean the people using it are using it to the full or whatever. It's all down to the people.
Very really. True. It is. And also, you know what? You spend time learning the ways that the machine works.
Yes,
so then just think that you can just assume that the next machine on can just be an extension of that logic. It's not going to work that way. The Amiga has strengths, for sure. And that means you can create new ways to play games. It has a mouse, for example, which works really well. So therefore, you know, games that would adopt that and utilize that as part of the, you know, barbarian, crap of barbarian aside. But, you know, some of the games that came later, you know, even the sensible games that came later, you know, Cannon Fodder. Yeah, see, so once the mechanics of learning what made great Amiga games great started to take off, you started to see great Amiga games, the same with the C64. Just to assume that the Amiga would be able to do a better version just because it's got 512K and all the other things, it's not about that. The C64 versions of like Whizball, for example, were really maximizing the capabilities of that machine, and it had some really great sound. Now, you know, you can't just take that out and plug it into an Amiga and go, there you go, because it's not going to work. You haven't got a Martin Galway soundtrack, for example, doing the thing on the Amiga. Yeah. You haven't got, you know, of course the graphics are going to be high fidelity, but it was never about the graphics being high fidelity that made it good. So I think you just, as the technology gets better, you know, the games don't immediately change and get better just because the machines are out there. It takes time for those developers to really get the best out of those machines. And the Amiga has some amazing capabilities that in those early days they weren't utilizing. They were just throwing graphics on the screen. It's got so much power behind the way it can control a screen and control a sprites and create hardware sprites and blitter and all of that stuff. It's crazy powerful. And that only came later down the line. So, you know.
And also as well, during this period as well, as we're seeing with the C64 games, is that game design is still is evolving in front of our eyes as we're doing these podcasts. You know, we're seeing new things appear. And so Amiga design was still in that, you know, it was still in 8-bit land. It just was in a 16-bit machine. So, you know, you could.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that. And then, you know, when games did come out that were really good on the Amiga, they were really good. You know, think of Alien Breed, think Project X, some other Team 17 stuff. Think think later down the line when you've got Syndicate and stuff like that and some of the great Amiga games, Monkey Island, for example. Once they figured out the best nuances and the best ways to make those games, they really started to just take off.
Yeah, they were building
When you get Doom 2 later down the line, well, you've got the precursor to loads and loads of those Command & Conquer games, haven't you? So
Yeah. Nick Bungus, a couple of questions and some techie questions. Graham, you first. How did you develop C64 demos? Did you have an expanded C64? What assembly did you use?
So, did I have an expanded 64? No, I had a bog standard brown bread bin 64. Yeah. I did change the LED light for a green one though, because I'm, you know, quirky that way. And I wore the keyboard out. It actually had no, some of the key characters had no letters on them because they would run out, especially the restore key, which was blank. How did I develop demos? I was old school assembler, so I didn't use an assembler package. I had an Action Replay cartridge, which had a built-in machine code assembler, and I used that. And the way I taught myself was to look at how people were doing it in their demos. And luckily, I also had my friend Joe, who was just a savant at stuff like that. Yeah. So, you know, we'd plug them into the C64. And then just, you know, working code would emerge. Because they were just really gifted like that. So we kind of disassembled. That's what a disassembler was for. So when you got a cartridge, you got a disassembler. And so you would disassemble demos. You would look at how they did stuff, try and figure it out yourself, and then try and code it from scratch. That's how you learn how to do raster splits and all the rest of the stuff, and then sprite multiplexers and all of that. And you just figure it out that way. So I never used an old-fashioned, what you call an assembler and a compiler. I never did that. I literally ran machine code in the machine, which has its problems when things crash if you haven't saved, which was a counterpoint to many swear words and angry exchanges in my bedroom from time to time. That's how I did it. You know, nothing expanded about it, no magic formula. No. I suppose, could you count an Action Replay cartridge as an expansion? I suppose it is. But I had an Expert cartridge before that, which I never found as good. The Action Replay 6, de facto, the best cartridge. And then at that point, I never used it for freezing games either, which you could do. I literally used it for coding, and that was it.
Yeah. So. Or if you hit you're saying about not saving or hitting the restore key too hard and wobbling the cartridge.
Yeah, you could wobble that, or you could freeze the lock the chip up. I mean, you could just do that by putting the wrong opcode in the wrong setting on the C64 and just locks the, and that's it. You're done. You got to reset, and if you hard reset, you've lost everything. Also, the power pack was one of those old fashioned black bricks, which would periodically just switch itself off anyway if it decided it was going to. It's a bit temperamental at best.
Yeah.
And then, just as a final thing, there, of course, it wasn't just all, you know, there were tools built to help you make demos back then. There were scroll text editors. There was stuff like that. And so we utilized some of those. All the graphics we drew for the demos were all drawn on Koala Paint, all our logos and everything. Not all by me. I did do a couple of them. But again, you know, Joe was the person that would just create those kind of things. And just,
yeah, they were very good. You know, they're very, very good.
Very, very talented person. Yeah, totally.
Second question is to me. Apart from your shoot 'em up construction kit game, a heli squad, I guess, did you code much C64? And if so, what was your proudest achievement? I didn't, not really. I wasn't particularly into coding. I did some basic stuff. I created a Dungeons & Dragons character generator. That was quite
you
good.
Did.
So you could basically do all your dice rolls and give your character and say which is best and all that kind of stuff. I did a couple of games. Never really. I kind of finished them, but only I don't think I ever games. But in the Quill, a couple of adventure games. But I never actually did any. I could never get my head around assembler. Just couldn't. So, I never really did much in the way of coding on the C64. But, yeah, there you go. Daniel Spreadbury asks, what was your joystick of choice back in the C64 days? For me, it was, or for Dan, It was the Competition Pro or the Quickshot 2, but a friend of mine at the time swore by the Konix Navigator, which I thought was the least ergonomic thing I'd ever used. I'm going to have to look that up because I've never heard of it. What's the Konix Navigator?
Well, I could tell you. Mine's an easy one. So I started with a Quickshot 2 because everybody had a Quickshot 2.
Yeah,
well,
that's what we started with.
And then quickly realized it was a piece of shit. And so, and then the next joystick I got was a Competition Pro, the one with the big round red buttons and the big red stick. That was the next joystick I got. I had that until I got an Amiga. And when I got the Amiga, I got the Arcade Pro, which is the one with the kind of the black one with the kind of square glow buttons.
Yellow buttons, weren't they?
They were glow in the dark buttons. Yeah, they were kind of luminous yellow. And I had that until I got rid of my Amiga. And the joystick I use now is the one that came with the C64 Maxi, which is ironically a Competition Pro, again, with the red buttons and whatnot. Yeah. That's it.
We started with a Quickshot 1.
They weren't good either.
You'd look at it and it'd wobble. Then we got a Quickshot 2 with the Turbo Fire. That was quite handy and nice.
Handy.
But broke. And then after that, we just went for the old stalwart Atari joysticks.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with them.
So those Atari joysticks were just unbreakable. They were just the sturdiest bits of kit. Not they weren't micro switched or anything like that, but they would, they would laugh at the face of Decathlon and things like that. They just could not be broken. I think Gary had them as well. Gary had some of those Atari joysticks. But I think I had that till the end of time. That was it.
I mean, they are pretty much the short stem, aren't they?
Yeah.
And the Quickshot had this really, because it had really naff leaf springy type switches in it. It wasn't micro switch.
No.
And so I prayed for a micro switch joystick, which is why I got the one I got. But I just didn't have it because the Atari one, you can't argue the Atari ones. When the end of times come, there's going to be cockroaches. Yeah, the cockroaches will be using them for houses probably. Yes. So my only quirk sort of side quest, if you like, where I just tried something a bit different one time, I did end up purchasing a Konix Speed King. Which was supposedly the ergonomic one. It's like a blob. It's like a amorphous blob. It was fist shaped almost.
With trigger underneath.
Fist of your hand. Yeah, with a trigger on you. Yeah. It was weird. It felt incorrect to be fingering the trigger that way.
My friend had one of them for his Amstrad.
And it was, it's right handed as well. If you were left handed, it wouldn't work because the button was fixed. You can't imagine it now that they would release something so inaccessible. But yeah, I had that briefly, but it was I'm not quite sure why I got it. I'm not sure if I didn't get it as a present at some point because whatever reason, but I was always Competition Pro
never
after
liked
that.
It. I don't like pressing the fire button like that.
You can't. No, that's what I said. It's weird. It's fingering the fire button. It's not right from underneath. Something wrong about it.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the Konix Navigator and it's a similar sort of thing, except it's got the triggers at the front. It's blue as well. So it looks like that the red one, which has got a picture in there. Yeah. I don't like the look of that either.
A little nubby joystick as well, like a nubbin.
It's like the GameCube C-Stick sort of, the yellow stick on the GameCube controller. Don't like that.
I mean, what appealed to me for the Competition Pro was because it looked like an arcade stick. It looked like the ones you'd see in the really good arcades, a giant stick with a bobble on the top.
Yeah.
I mean, and it had suckers at the bottom, so you could clamp it to your desk or to a dinner mat, which is what I used to stick mine on, like a dinner mat, and then you stick it in your lap and you'd be able to really go for it.
Yeah.
Quickshot 2 had suckers on the bottom, which didn't help you because in the end it would just snap, or the button, the trigger button, because there was a button on the top, a thumb button, wasn't there? It was shaped like a control stick for a kind of an aeroplane.
Yes.
It had a thumb button on the top, and it had a trigger button, ridges
to put your fingers in, wasn't it? And you sort of...
So it's all very ergonomic, very phallic, actually, you're sort of gripping the shaft, as it were. And then gently squeezing the various the button points. But at the same time, it was doomed. Yeah. The more you waggled that thing, you knew it was destined for the end.
I think the thing was, the key point was the taller the joystick, the more it was doomed. So that's why the Competition Pro, quite short, not massive sticks.
Yeah.
The Atari short. You don't need the taller. There's just more waggle and more flip, more flop.
It's more distance. You know what? At the end of the day, it's in those early ones, it's a lever. So if you're going to press your lever hard to the left, there's a long distance there.
Yeah.
And it's not like these are going to sort of slowly increase in speed. Like, they're not analog.
No.
So, you have to just press all the way to the left. And it meant that you were yanking that thing around. And in some people's hands, like Gary, that's a dangerous thing to happen.
Very, very dangerous. I've seen him handle an Atari joystick.
Exactly.
He does it weird. He did it from the top.
He's squeezed so many brown sauce tubes empty in one hit. No, he's very powerful grip, very powerful. You know, if he slams the back, you know, when you get the bottle and you pat the back of the bottle to get the sauce out. If he does that, it all comes out in one go. He's the most powerful back patter I've ever seen.
Yeah, he's pasted his sister to the wall once. It came out so hard. He was just pasted to the wall with brown sauce.
I'm glad you finished that sentence off then for a minute. I'm like, let's quickly leave that. I'm having horrible thoughts.
David Hearn Writer asks, I guess this to me, did any of your Quill adventures survive? No, none of my, I've got none of my original hardware or anything, so no, they're all gone the way of the dodo, I'm afraid. Nick Bungus, do you think the next Ask the Podcast will be Xmas, or is that too soon? Too soon?
Yeah, too soon, sorry. Oh, hang on.
Interactive question. Next Ask the Podcast, could you go through all the interlude C64 tunes you commonly use? Tell us which games they're from. I guess that's to you, Graham. It bugs me now, as I always think I used to play that game back in the day, but I'm probably more used to hearing it on Zap to the Past.
There's actually a large collection of tunes that I use for that, and it's an ever-expanding collection.
Yeah.
Now, generally speaking, my rule of thumb has been, if the music is good enough and they have an interstitial, that's, I can use, in between the games, I will use the one that's kind of linked to that game or the game before or after, depending on how good they are. That's my general rule of thumb around that. However, I'm also noting that sometimes the games just simply don't have them, and so I have to use other ones. Generally speaking, there are some common ones I'll go to, and that's because in the early days of Galway and Hubbard, they had a lot of interstitial music. So that's why you'll hear sometimes I use quite a bit of Rambo, quite a bit of Green Beret, quite a lot of the early Rob Hubbard tunes, because you'll hear that. So Monty on the Run is used at the end of every podcast as the final bit. Because that's just a sort of a quirk. And there's loads of them. I mean, there's too many to tell. You know, common ones you'll hear sometimes, Bionic Commando, you'll hear quite a bit, because there's a couple of ones I really like out of that. Hawkeye, you'll often hear. You'll often hear dun, 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 which is Robocop. And there's a few of them like that you'll hear. There's a few very rare ones I'll throw in now and again. In early days, I used to use some of the, again, they're Galway ones, but some of the like Rastan ones and stuff like that. I kind of, you know, they got a bit annoying after a while, some of those ones, and some of them lend themselves to doing it, some of them don't. So there's a few Matt Gray ones that are quite good, and then every now and again you'll get a real naff one, same with some of the Hubbard ones sample. So I could write down an entire list of them all at some point and make it available to the patrons, just, you know, if it eases your obvious suffering that you must get, because you think, what is that? Damn it, I know I've heard that. But that's kind of the fun of it.
To be fair, I get the same thing, because I reckon it's when we'll play a game and I'm like, oh, that's where he's got that from. Loads of times, because I don't recognise them all, I'm like, oh, that's a good tune. Then I'll play something, I'm like, oh, that's where it's from.
Yeah. I mean, so I one that thing. One that I don't use very often, but is one that I really like, and it's because it's a bit longer than usual, is the Gauntlet music. Because I really like that. But because that's Little Ben Dalglish tune that's often overlooked, and it's about 28 seconds long, I think, in its entirety, which is often a bit too long for an interstitial. But that said, and the average time for them all is between sort of 5 and 10 seconds. I try and aim for that maximum, really. So there you go.
Nick also asks, Breadbin or C64C?
I had Breadbin. Breadbin for me. I never owned never owned one. No. And also that has a different chipset in it, so it I would never have come to terms with it.
Absolutely. It wouldn't have fitted with my Transom.
No, the SID chip in it's different, so it plays samples differently, so they're quieter. Yeah. They're a lot quieter in the 64C, so they would have done my head in.
Wouldn't have liked that, no.
I mean, it's bad enough that my I don't know about you, but I've found when I play some of these SIDs back, my C64 played them completely differently to how I hear them. I've not really found a successful emulation yet of some of the tunes, especially things like Light Force or some of the Hubbard ones, where there's some filtering in it. Some of them sound really weirdly squashy on the emulation. They get this kind of gulpy squash sound. I didn't have that on my C64 at all. They very much sound like, in the best, the closest one I've come to is if you go to the Oak Valley, whatever they call it, SID archive, and the other ones you can play, the MP3 ones you can play online, where it has the different chip revisions. I found that the revision 2 chip is closest on more generally to the one that I had in my C64. But if you had mine was a darker Breadbin. If you had the earlier, lighter form Breadbin, you probably had an R1 chip, and that sounded completely different. So weird.
True. And then one for me, just says from Nick, and it's just Green Beret. Why? It's okay, but nothing special in my opinion. So I actually answered this on the Discord. So I'm just going to read what I put because I think it succinctly will sort of why I think Green Beret is amazing.
Because I do.
Yeah, because I do. I support it's everything special in a game from the period. It's perfectly balanced in terms of skill. In terms of skill needed and challenge offered, it's easy to pick up, difficult to master. It's got a simple set of variables to get your head around, and easy to use power-ups that are limited and must be used at the optimum times for maximum effect. It feels very responsive, looks and sounds great. The C64 conversion gets all of this right. It uses respawning enemies, but in a way that does not overwhelm, and then mixes them up as the levels progress to keep the challenge fresh. If you die, there's no power-ups to recollect, which is such a bugbear of mine. So it's always down to just your skill at the game as to how far you can get. So there's probably more reasons, but I think that covers the major points why I love it so much. It's just a perfect, you know, it's how good you are at that game. It's, you know, it's similar when I look at it. It's, you know, I see other games that are trying to do this. We saw that one the other week, that Ninja Warriors, just not as good. They don't do it as well. They miss that thing. The three levels, so you can jump around, you can avoid stuff, you can jump over people. Your abilities to overcome the enemies are simple, but they work. And so, you know, it's just a perfect game. I don't know. I've always loved it. It ate so much of my money in the mid-80s in the arcade. So much. And when that conversion came out, I was so thankful that it was as good as it was.
It is good. I mean, and my little own history, I mean, I'm not, it's okay, Green Beret. I've always loved the music more than anything else. And I remember, I think before on this podcast, I bought Green Beret, but I went out and bought V with some, I think it might have been birthday money. Got V, brought it back home. Played it, couldn't get through the first bleeding door because, of course, who can? Took it back with a kind of didn't load, and they tested it in the shop. This was in Boots, tested it, and luckily, for some reason, just said ready, run, ready by some miracle. Might have helped that I ran a magnet over it, but no, that's by neither here nor there. But anyway, so it didn't work. So then, as they said, would you like to choose a different game? Obviously, and I was like, yeah, can I have the Green Beret? Now, bear in mind that this was a trip to town on the bus with a sister, and it then brought me then. So when I got back and this was also the C64 plugged into the big telly in the lounge because it was the one on colour. The whole family kind of sat around, but not necessarily watching what I was doing, but just in the lounge. And then I remember to this day, I remember when the music for Green Beret came on. Now that, And I remember everyone thinking, that sounds, you know, there was a general kind of, wow, it wasn't what they expected. And then when the game came on, I think everyone was well impressed. It's kind of weird to think of it now. You wouldn't imagine it. Maybe the people listening to this podcast probably do. But it was like, it was a bit like, not like a family event, but I think everyone wanted the game to be good because I'd been so disappointed with V. I wasn't very old at the time, not old. And so when it loaded and there was this, not just a kind of, oh, great, I'm pleased that he likes it. But, you know, there was a kind of, wow, that's really impressive. Mm. And it sort of justified my whingering for about a year and a half to get a Commodore 64 as well. So it was kind of, you know, it was like, you see, I told you it was good, but, you know, said in a nicer way than that. Yeah. So, yeah, there you go.
There you go. It is a great game. ALH2 Retro asks, favorite classic 80s and early 90s supercar as popularized by video games, which would you choose and why? I've always been a Porsche person. I don't think it's been, because the only Porsche games were the Need for Speed. I think it used Porsche, wasn't it? There was a Need for Speed Porsche.
Yeah, I think maybe. Yeah,
the supercars,
that Need for Speed.
As for supercars, it's always been the Porsche 911, I think.
Yeah, I liked, in games, I guess, I've always liked the Ferrari Testarossa, then it's made up Ferrari, that, but it's, you know, it's the closest approximation. I don't like the Ferrari F40 particularly because it's kind of boxy, but I do like the Testarossa, the shape of that. I always liked the Porsche, but I never liked the 911. I liked, but the 924 was always the Porsche I already, you know, I looked at that and I was like, that is super cool. But that's just, you know, that's a personal choice. I'd have one of those tomorrow.
Yeah, so
924 was just kind of a cool looking Porsche that was kind of a bit more everyman and less looking like a Volkswagen Beetle at the back. But in those early 80s and 90s games, you know, I don't know, the best representation you got was in those Need for Speed? Test Drive, is it?
Test Drive.
So the ones in Test Drive, and out of the ones in Test Drive, the Porsche was the better one, I think, out of the looks of a car.
But I'd also want the last V8, whatever that was.
But that's a V8 Jensen Interceptor, isn't it?
Oh, there you go then. That'll do.
It's the Jensen, a classic Jensen, yeah. Classic
Jensen?
Muscle car Jensen. Yeah.
Jensen?
Yeah. Jensen. Jensen Interceptor, yeah.
David Hearn asks, have you forgiven Zap for not giving away the Exploding Fist a gold medal yet? I know it got bettered by AK and AK Plus, but at the time it's pretty special. No, I haven't.
Those wounds run pretty deep. No.
Absolutely.
It should have been a gold medal. It's ridiculous that it didn't get that.
Even on my deathbed, I won't forgive.
Nope. The two greatest fighting games of all time on the C64 one-to-one combat games did not get gold medals. There you go. What does that tell you?
Yeah, they didn't know what was in front of them properly, I think.
Nope.
David, he also asks, You can erase one and only one C64 game from history, saving poor gamers from losing their cash and granny from getting pushed down the stairs after buying it as a present. Which one do you choose?
Oh, that's so difficult.
There's so many. God.
It's got to be a full price game because, you know, budget games aren't going to earn granny a, you know, kick down the stairs.
No. I think...
So it'd be a full price game for that.
For a full price, C64 has been so many bad stuff recently. Yeah. I mean, Karnov is probably one that springs into mind because it's
such a bad...
Yeah,
any of those arcade ones like
Commodore
that,
yeah. 64 version. Yeah. That should have been pretty decent, but loads of those arcade conversions. If it's an original game, probably Lee Enfield.
Yeah, I don't think... And that was full price as well, wasn't it? I think. Goodness me, yeah.
Or Win Bobner.
Yeah, any of them. You have to erase them. I mean, games that I was likely to... Like, a game that I did get that should have been erased, you know, one that I actually did get in... And no grannies were harmed in the making of this podcast, but that I did get that I was very unhappy with. I don't know. I didn't get a lot of games like that because I was very directive about if someone's going to buy me a game, I was kind of almost hinting to give me the money and I'll choose it. No, they didn't. Very rare that I got a game like that, especially a full price one. Mm. So, because they wouldn't have known, my family and extended family would have had no idea what to get me as a game. So,
yeah.
No, I think I'd Win Bobner, any of those, possibly Ready, because it's so shite. Yeah,
Running Man. It's just Running so, Man, so any of them. Badness.
Any license, there's a number of Elite games, a number of Ocean games I would erase out of that as well.
He also asked, did you ever try the Amiga version of Elite? I did and got hooked on it all over again. No, I didn't.
I did. Yeah, I played the Amiga version of Elite, and then I played the one that came afterwards. And was it Frontier?
Frontier, yeah.
I played them on the Amiga, but they got the same amount of time that all of those kind of games get from me, which is like, oh wow, end.
Lave, Dizzo.
Yeah, as soon as because ultimately that's the game, isn't it? No matter how pretty, I even got like Elite for the Xbox One. You know, the big posh new one. Got that. Sat down, was like, right, here we go. Trading with Lave and Dizzo. I'm like, oh, some things just are boring. Sorry, but they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I get it. It's an amazing, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I've seen some amazing stuff online from people who've really explored and got the most out of those games. But for me, I'm just like, oh, I'm never going to want to do that.
No.
It does look amazing though, but I never want to do that really.
Yeah. And also, did you ever try the sequel to Mercenary on the Amiga, Damocles? A landmark game, he says.
So when you say try, I mean, the way I tried it was I put it in my disk drive to see if it would work. When it did, I copied it then and sent it on to all the contacts across the world on the pirate version I had. Sorry.
not something I was ever going to be bothered with. When I got I only had an Amiga quite late and I was primarily for word processing, Premier Manager and Swiv. That was pretty much
I was doing most of the Amiga music stuff at this point, but if I was trading any games, it was just, that was it. I'd get the discs, check they worked and pass them on.
Yeah, stuff on Optimed. I was doing stuff on Optimed as well, Lee Dove asks, listening to the current episode, you mentioned Demon's Kiss. This game appears to have never been reviewed anywhere. Another one to add to the missing game episode? Yeah.
Yes. And that's what I mean when we come across them and we identify them, we're like, we do add them to we have got a big catalogue of those and a list of those. So it definitely added to the list, that one.
Yeah, it did. Etienne asks, not a question, but a remark. My wife doesn't like you guys. Oh. I won't tell you why, but I'll give you a clue. She's a wet, wet, wet and Marty Pillow fan.
Marty's pillows.
Marty's old knee neck. We hope you're listening.
Some people like him. Some people like wet, wet, wet. Not me, though.
Not me. I prefer dry, dry, dry. But
It's just a no.
Crisp and dry. No, we're very sorry. We're sorry your wife doesn't like us. But we'll stand by our views on wet, wet, wet and an old knee neck.
Exactly. So I've always thought Marty Pello could have released a lubricant, couldn't he? Because then it could have had on the side, it's wet, wet, wet.
When you dry, dry, dry. When you dry, 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 get wet, wet, wet.
Exactly, yeah. It's Marty Pello's lube. He produces it himself. He secretes it.
It smells of what's it?
It's the same colour.
No one wants that. No wonder she don't like us.
We're not endearing. I was going to say, we're not endearing ourselves to Etienne's wife there. We apologise for now, for in the past, and also we'll apologise for the future because
for the future,
we're ever going to stop. Knee neck's going to always be a thing for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Roger Dodger asks, I've been wondering over the last few years if this might come up, but off the back of the recent glut of Ocean movie licences, are there any movie licences past or present on any platform you've enjoyed? Yes. GoldenEye.
Yeah, you liked GoldenEye on the old N65.
Not specific. I mean, it's tangential to the game, but Escape from Butcher Bay, the Riddick game on the Xbox, that was very good.
Yeah,
and Dark Athena, this follow-up on Xbox 360, they were very good games. Other movie titles. I mean, we quite like License to Kill, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah. I guess I don't know that. I'm trying to think of movie license games. No, recent games I've played and I can't really think of any.
Yeah, generally they're just dreadful. There was a glut of them through the sort of PS1, PS2 era with, you know, the Phantom Menace and the pod racing game on the N64 was pretty good.
I didn't play any of them.
That was all right. Episode one racer, that was pretty good. It got re-released recently.
I can't even think of any on the Amiga that I played that were any good. So no. I remember I actually got...
Did you play the Indiana Jones games?
Maybe. Yeah, I suppose you could count them. Yeah, I played them on, I think I played PC versions of those later down the line. I suppose them.
Yeah.
I can't think of any others that I played that were sort of specifically movie tie-ins like that. Indiana Jones must be probably one of the only few that I did.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's any others.
I'm trying to think of any Amiga ones. I got Nightbreed with my Amiga, I think, or I certainly got it in the early days of it, but I think it was so crap I never really played it.
There you go. There's not many.
And Days of Thunder as well. That was rubbish, so bad. Bother with that.
Well, we'll have to look at, I think, on the C64 at some point.
Oh, God help us.
David Hearn asks, favourite Cinemaware game, C64 or Amiga? Probably a cross between Defender of the Crown and... it was too hard, but I loved the atmosphere of it, and that was It Came from the Desert.
Yeah, I think Defender of the Crown, I think a safe bet. But I like Rocket Ranger as well, because I just like the kind of vibe it set on the Amiga, and Defender of the Crown on the C64 as a preference.
Yeah,
but that's principally it. The others are okay, but they're not as good as them, as I recall.
No. I did like the atmosphere of It Came from the Desert.
It's good. On the opening was good, but I like them. Them is one of my favourite black and white movies of all time. So it had that appeal. It's a shame that nothing else has ever been done with that concept. It's crazy to me that nothing's ever been done with that. Yeah, just it's crazy.
Yeah, we need Phase 5. Ever, that's what we need.
Well, if there was ever a film that's just primed for a really good remake, especially now when you've got all the sort of crazy world situations going on with global climate change and all this, you've got it primed ready for a giant ants movie or even just an ants attacking movie.
Yeah.
You know, we should bring some of these back. They were good. Some instances.
Yeah.
Empire of the Ants, not so much, but the other's good.
Ant Attack. I suppose Ant Attack was the closest, wasn't it? Back on the Spectrum.
Just not even in the games, they're just... I know there's the... What's it called now? There's the one that's basically Starship Troopers on the PC, isn't there?
The new one.
The Sony one. Yeah, that's having a bigger...
I'll come back to me in a minute. But yeah, I haven't got it yet.
Something Landers, is it? Or I can't remember.
Oh, God damn it.
I saw it on the news the other day that they're releasing a sequel and it's, you know, hugely popular.
Helldivers.
Helldivers. I don't know why I said Landers. Helllanders sounds really nice. But yeah, the Helldivers. I've never played it, but I saw it in the news the other day that it's, you know, super popular. So, That's giant bugs. And of course, there's always EDF. The games, version 6, apparently the 6th episode of that is coming out.
Yeah.
Classic Earth Defense Force. That's a little bit of a hidden gem. You introduced me to that, and it's one of the greatest games of all time. It's totally off the radar for most people. Yeah. Crazy. And again, another one's coming on, essentially EDF 6. Yeah, exactly. You know what? They are a little hidden gem, those. But again, they're not on the C64 Amiga, so.
No. It was a question, that one. Daniel Spreadbury asks, a more C64 related question, did you have any add-ons for it, the C64, like Koala Tablet, Commodore Music Expander, or the little Commodore printer plotter, or anything like that? No, I don't think I did. I had a backup board, I suppose.
You had the backup board? Yeah, because you were duplicating your dirty pirate.
I was a filthy, you know, you wouldn't steal a car, would you?
Tape pirate.
No, I wouldn't.
Honestly, didn't we all live in fear of the Federation Against Software Theft? They made it sound like some elite group. They were going to SWAT team down your house, don't they, and appear in a helicopter like the SAS and crash through your bedroom window and drop that tape. It's like, well, really? You know, it was just, honestly. And then we heard the rumours, didn't you? Oh, God, did you hear about, you know, insert person you didn't even know. They got fined thousands for having a copy. Yeah. Whatever. No, never happened, did it?
Yeah.
Hardware-wise, I had an expert cartridge and then that got biffed for an action replay. I had a Commodore 64 disk drive, obviously the 15, whatever the hell it was, 1541?
Yeah.
Or 1571, I can't remember. But then I also had a Citizen 120D printer as well.
Which was the second
noisiest printer in the universe, because the noisiest one was the one I had for the Amiga, which was so loud I had to cover it in duvets and pillows, and even then it was loud.
Your family did not enjoy us printing our fanzine off at 4 o'clock in the morning.
No, they did not. I got so much shit over that. What was that bloody racket all night? Because it was dot matrix, and it was just, you needed to print, if you needed to print in its, because it had its own sort of built-in typeface, which was great, but it was type. It was like type. But if you wanted to print typefaces and fonts like we did, we it was all dot matrix, so it would be, oh, it's shrill.
And everything has to be printed twice to make it dark enough to sort of be red. To type as long.
And so much ink tapes that they were. I never had a Koala tablet. And I did have a music keyboard overlay thing that was crap that came with the Commodore 64 when I got it, but I never bothered with it. It was broken within a minute or two. It was crappy, plastic printed rubbish.
Mark Fletcher asks, your stunt car racer review got me thinking of who you feel is the best. That's the most technically accomplished programmer the C64 had in comparison to your favorite programmer. Appreciate they may be one and the same, but interested in everyone's thoughts. So I think this is we split this into games, because I think the stuff that people the techie demos that people are doing these days are absolutely off the chart. So we'll put them
crazy.
People to one side, like Raceland and Fairlight and all those kind of people. We'll put those people because they're in a different league. And obviously they've had 35 years to sort of really get to know the machine and stuff. Back then, who do you think? What do you think? Who do you think was the most technically accomplished?
Technically accomplished, Archie MacLean, Andrew Braybrook.
Yeah.
To name just two off the top of my head.
Chris Butler,
you know, he became, technically very proficient.
Yeah. Roland, the others we're going to see.
Yeah, this was the guy that did Stunt Car Racer himself, of course. I mean, Jeff Crammond,
John Twiddy.
Jeff. There's a few, and then there's even some of the ocean ones that we've come across before. They might not be necessarily working for the greatest company and with the greatest ethics, but the coding chops on some of them guys has always been good. You know, they invented some of the key multiplexers that were really kind of pioneering at the time.
Dave Collier.
It is, yeah. It is.
I'd also throw in, as much as we don't particularly appreciate his style of games, Jeff Minter's got to be in there, I think.
I think Jeff Minter's got a place. You've got to give him that.
Sean Southern.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Actually, I forgot about Sean Southern, yeah. There's some really talented programmers out there for C64 for games.
Cuddly Cricks.
Yeah, goes without saying, yeah.
That's the list. And there's probably some of the American guys, people like Noah Falstein.
I mean, who's the guy that did Nebulous? I mean, that was pretty good as well. They just did one-offs, didn't they?
Yeah, Nebulous. That was, what's his name? It was John Phillips.
Yeah, because he didn't know what other things he did, but that was pretty good.
He did Eliminator. That was pretty much
it. Oh, there you go. That was pretty good.
But like I said, the guys who did... Like, there's a lot of the American guys as well. So the people at
Bruce Carver and that.
Yeah, Bruce, the Carvers. There's the, like, Noah Falsey and stuff, the people who did the Eidolon and Coronas Rift. I mean, imagine trying to get them working in 8-bit machines doing fractal generated landscapes. The Epics guys, who did Summer Games 2 and Winter Games, the classics.
LucasArts,
I know it's not answering the question so much because you asked us for one, but there's too many good ones. Mm.
Well, if I was going to pick one that's sort of always provided amazing things wherever they've gone, that was Archie MacLean for me, because I don't think I've ever played a bad game by Archie MacLean on anything he made games on.
Yeah, true. I mean, that's a good one.
No.
Yeah.
If I had to pick one out of the lot, I mean, that's not saying that they've all got their own strengths and weaknesses, but just for, you know, partly because he sadly passed away, but also because the legacy of games he left behind, IK Plus on the Amiga and all, the guy was just amazing. So, I'm just, you got to love that.
And Archie MacLean's pool, he made pool fun.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, the great games on the Amiga that he did are just, there you go. If I had to pick one, that would be it. But there's loads of them. And just by the way, for demos, modern demos, HCL, I think he's Booze Design now. The guys, I don't know how the guy codes what he codes. It's just insane, the stuff they're doing now. It's insane.
Yeah.
No, if you want a really clever, there's a demo. It isn't by HCL, actually, ironically. It's by Fairlight. But go and watch the No Sprites demo by Fairlight if you want to see something that will blow your mind. It was entered into a demo competition where you have to use only sprites. And they invented a way of being able to utilize certain hard techniques on the C64. I don't know how they've done it, but they've got scrolling messages and background images and all sorts. And there are no sprites in it at all. Neither is their characters. So go and check it out.
Yeah, it's crazy shit. Gary, being happy.
All right.
Just laying out some facts. 35 months times 2 episodes each, 70 episodes. Best part of 18 months. 2 years of your life, holidays and one-offs. How long the whole process? 5 years. That's 10% of your whole existence on reviewing these games. Cheers, Gary. That's 20% of your life just watching sprites go. This is why we call him Happy Gary.
Chirpy Gary. You know what? He's just going through a phase where he's just compartmentalizing his life by percentage. And my response to that would be, how much life your percentage of your life have you spent being a miserable twat? And the answer to that is quite a lot.
Yeah.
And I can say that with complete confidence.
Yeah. We do love you, Gary. You know we do love you, but...
Yeah, we do. But only for a certain percentage of the time.
Yeah, the other percentage, we don't.
We don't, yeah. We don't like it at all.
Lee Dove asked, the final issue of Zap, issue 90, will cover 8 games. It does. I've plotted them all out. One of which is Neighbours, based on the TV show. What a way to go out. Oh, God. It is. It's not going to be our last game we looked at. I made sure of that, though.
Good.
But we will be looking at it. I think it's... It looks weird. It's just Scott. It looks like a Paperboy ripoff. I don't know, though. I didn't have a proper look.
Which, apart from anything else, he never was in the TV show. So.
No. Nick Bungus asked, the C64 has a certain graphics look, mainly the palette and the medium res pixels. Which games would you say look the least Breadbin-esque? In a good way.
Some of the later games that come out start to really, you know, the Mayhem in Monsterland or whatever, sort of stuff, they start to really look incredible because they're using clever colour tricks and all sorts of fancy pants stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
The least Breadbin-esque at the moment.
Tau City, I think that looked.
Yeah.
Very Breadbin-esque.
Good call, actually. Yeah, I think some of those, like you said, those LucasArts games, Fractalus and stuff like that. They don't necessarily look classically C64-y, really.
Ball Blazer.
And then maybe, Last Ninja type games, because they've got a nice palette look about them. They're nice isometric colours and they're very colourful. And the Oriental Gardens levels on the C64 version still to this day look really good. So.
I never thought particularly that Impossible Mission looked particularly a C64 game.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
Considering the time, 1984 that was, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I'd say Sacred Arm of Antiriad for the same reasons, actually. The graphics in that blew me away when I first saw that. Mm. So.
Yeah, yeah. Cauldron 2 is another good one.
Yeah.
So there you go. Mr. Tossington asks, so, no, it's a long way off, but when you finish all the Zaps, would you consider doing a special on new games covered in the new Zaps, or at least a feature to see how the modern C64 games stack up to the old and in their own right? Probably, maybe, yes, I think it's...
Yeah, I'd say there's a likelihood, isn't there? Yeah. We've looked at some of them already, but only looked, not in the context of recording anything, but when the people have mentioned them to us, I've had a look at the Sonic and look at the Mario and stuff like that, and there's a case, isn't there? There's a case for it, I think, so... Yeah.
There is. Nick Bungus asks, we're seeing some very questionable scores from Zap, especially from licensed games and arcade conversions. Do you think this is all down to backhanders in brown envelopes, or do you think there are other factors in play? I always felt there was a willingness for conversions to be good on the C64 because of the impending threat of the 16 bits and also because we were Team C64 and had a bias. I don't know. I think, as we've just seen with Operation Thunderbolt, I think a lot of these reviews we're seeing are based on visits to the publishers and writing the review on the back of those before finish code is in their hand. Because, you know, you think about the lead time on these magazines, they're 2 or 3 months behind or in front. So that all needs to be done. You know, the game's probably not finished. There's a lot of stuff going in. I think there's also a bit of... we've said it. I think the not backhanders, but I think the pressure's coming from the publishers to withdraw advertising, which, you know,
potentially,
which will lead to loss of revenue and stuff. I think it's all those kind of things. I think it's just a bit of a mess. It's just a sad thing to see, as we've seen. Yeah. Just refer back to our Operation Thunderbolt review, because I think we discussed it in length there.
I would say that. I would agree with that. Yeah. Just look back at the, and our responses for those are quite clear. I think the final thing to add, I think, because you put there the impending threat of the 16 bits, I would never say it was an impending threat. I think the truth of the matter is that there was just a change happening.
Yeah.
No, the change was happening from 8-bit to 16-bit. It was a painful change, even for the people in the magazines. Everyone quite liked the C64. And so when the Amiga came along and it became a price point when it started to be affordable and the game started to really start to look good, so the C64 was being retired out of the popular magazines and stuff like that, as these things are. And it was a painful retirement for the C64 for many, because it was a machine that so many people really loved, obviously to this day. So I think that some of the reviews are just, they're heraldry reviews, because I don't think they really wanted to see the machine away. They still wanted, it still had its part to play. There's still some life in it still. And I think maybe there's a bit of that. But also, the Amiga was where it was rapidly becoming, where the money was. And at the end of the day, these magazines are, they're showing you the money. So they have to follow the money trail. There's no doubt about that. The Amiga was where all the games were going to be released and all the rest of it. So that's where you have to follow the money. And the C64, yes, they were also RANs. We've said it a few times. These games are being put out, but they're not the focus of the big pub. You know, that was, out of all the games that were being put out, all the versions of the games on the various platforms, the Amiga and the Atari ST and the 16-bit versions were where the money was.
Were the lead
all the rest of them are kind of just, all the rest of them are just kind of also RANs. So they're not going to spend as much time on them. They're not going to give them as much budget. They're not going to give them as much pressure. And if they can get a decent review out of the magazines by putting a bit of pressure on, well, if it sells an extra 1,000 copies, great. But they were, by this point, the C64 wasn't selling millions of games. It was, it was massive downturn we're talking about here. So
maybe.
I think that's part and parcel of it. But it doesn't excuse it, but I think that's where it's headed.
Yeah. Lee Dove asks, so here's a question that was inspired by the non-C64-like graphics question. When a game is ported, there's usually a lot of compromises, as the original may have run on better hardware, be encouraged to take advantage of a platform's quirks, or just have the advantage of a singular vision. What ports of original were better on the C64 than on the original platforms? He mentioned John Twitty's port of Pete Cook's Tau Ceti. Moves better, looks better, moves better, sounds better.
Yeah, I mean, we answered a few of these in our Patreon feed, didn't we? I mean, Defender of the Crown was better on the 64.
Yeah, as we found out with a bit of investigation, Monty on the Run was another one.
Yeah, Monty on the Run. We were questioning whether it was a Spectrum game originally. It kind of was-ish.
Yeah, you can tell by the sprites and the look of it. It looks like a Spectrum platformer.
Yeah, totally. And it's better. And I don't know if there are others like that. I don't know that, you'd have to go really into the weeds with it all, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I can't really think of many that came across the D64 from other platforms and benefited from it.
No, I don't, because generally speaking, when they were ported from the Spectrum, they just kind of ported the Spectrum. Yeah. So you ended up with games like Head Over Heels, which should have been better on the C64, but wasn't.
Yeah.
Isometric ones.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, they should have been better, could have been better, but they weren't. So.
And then you had things like from other machines. So you had, like we said, the LucasArts games. So the games like Fractalis, Cronus Rift, they were originally Atari 800 when they ran.
Yeah.
They ran better on those machines, even though they looked good and played well on the C64, but they did run better on those Atari machines a bit faster.
They did, a bit faster.
So I don't know, but those, Defender of the Crown and Monty on the Run, there you go. Daniel Spreadbury says, Adrian, it sounds like you teach game design. Did you work in the industry before you went into academia? No, I did not. Not really. I played a lot of games. I knew a lot about games, but no, I didn't. I just got into it. Very lucky, right place, right time. Essentially, I had what you might call a midlife crisis, because I was just turning 40. I just turned 40, and I was like, I'm bored of my job. And an opportunity happened, and it was like, I can go teach video games. And it's like, that was that.
Yeah.
Apart from the Sook-based game, heard about in the pod when it was reading Zap, have you worked on any other games you might have played? Yeah, Shudder. I've mentioned that before. So go buy Shudder.
Yeah.
It's about less than a quid on Steam. As much as I like, it's a one button, one joystick game. It's an old style retro game. It's built like that. So there you go. And Graham, do you still do any work in the demo scene these days?
No, I don't. I don't have the time. I enjoy the fruits of other people's labor, nor have I got the technical skill to even get anywhere near what they're doing. So it would be embarrassing for me to do anything.
Which is the production that you did do that you're most proud of? And can we still find it archived somewhere?
You can. All of the S-Express demos are on the CSDB, which you can go and download for free. They're all there. You just have to search S-Express. They're all in there. And the one I'm most proud of out of all of those is a few, actually. But we did a big multi-part thing called Cyanide 2. There's some good parts in that, which is quite fun. There's loads of naff sexy scroll text though, so just bear that in mind. Young teenage scroll text. And then there's a couple of others. There was one that I worked with Joe, which was, I think there's a few of them now. I'm proud of all of the things that we did, because that was just a small gang of teenagers in a bedroom with a C64 just hacking out and just doing code and creating stuff, and that's an exciting thing to be part of back then.
I was like the last one that we did, The Eyes Have It. I was like that one.
Yeah, it never really got released. The last couple of demos we did were when once S-Express had kind of just it didn't end. I was selling my C64 and trading up to the Amiga at this point, and Joe had moved on to do other stuff, and Gary had long since stopped trading, and it was just coming to a natural end. And so we did a couple of final demos, one which was called The Eyes Have It, which we had all these animated dancing, bouncing eyes and things all over the place, loads of them. Lots of big fancy sort of FLI scrolls and stuff in there. It's quite nice, but it never really got released, I don't think.
Yeah, the Antiriad logo.
Yeah, we stole the background from the very first opening of Antiriad. The opening part of it was a giant FLI bouncing scroller with the graphic from Druid on it, which was the Druid horn thing. sort of extracted out. And then there was the background from the game, like you said, Sacred Adventure, but it had all these little animated eyes appearing as a multiplexer, strangely enough. So they multiplexed and appeared all over the place. So there was one that was on a little trampoline that was bouncing. Yeah. There was some that would just walk on and sort of wave and do stuff. And there was loads of little eyes all over the place and a giant scroll at the bottom, which was the first and last giant multi-character bouncing scroll that I did. Quite complicated bit of code for that. And it took me ages to get it working. And then I, for some reason, we never really released it. But it wasn't released as an S-Express demo, so it could be out there somewhere.
It could be. I don't know.
So I don't know. We didn't, you know, it wasn't an S-Express product because it didn't have it. You know, it was unbranded. It was just called The Eyes Have It. That was the last thing I ever did on the C64.
David Hearn, apart from the podcast, how have these old games affected your adult life? Example, Mind Shadow and Robots of Dawn helped me learn how to type.
Okay.
Old games
affected my adult life?
I mean, not the podcast, but I mean, utilizing a C64 back then, you know, introduced me to typing. I was good at, you learned the keyboards.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing what you've done there. I don't know if they helped me much in old games affecting my adult life. I don't think they have.
No, I don't think the games have ever done it. Having a C64, yeah, definitely that. I think having a C64 has led me to the kind of career that I have. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, same here. Yeah, exactly.
I fell in love with early IT from a very young age, and computers have been a part of my life ever since, and they still are to this day.
Yeah.
And not just using them for games, I went on to use them for everything, and I still do that right now. Making this podcast. So it's, you know, it's the exact example of the kind of thing we've always done. And obviously with AD and with Gary, the kind of thing as a trio we've always done. When I had an Amiga, we kind of made fanzines and magazines and videos. It was never just about the games. Even back in the C64, you know, we started as games, ended as demos and stuff like that. And even AD was doing scroll texts and doing stuff for the demos that we did. So it's not like it's always been more than just the games for me. And that
Shook and Quill and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It was never just about the game. So, what effects have the games had? It's more of what the effect the actual devices had, and the sort of all the trials you go through with those things.
What 80s music have you enjoyed the most and the least? Revisiting it for the podcast. I think there's a triple S. It's Shaking Stevens, Sam Fox, and anything by Saw.
Yeah, that's SAW.
Triple S.
Yeah, it's triple crap. Yeah. So this is actually an interesting question. Now, when it comes to 80s production, I think it's some of the best time for music production there's ever been, because it's so, the production stuff that happens is so amazingly polished up to a point when the robots take over and Stock Aitken and Waterman discover the machines become so good at making repeated music. That you end up with, you know, obviously the dance music and stuff like that separate, but you end up with just pop production stuff like Stock Aitken and Waterman. But you know, this is Depeche Mode, some of my favorite music from the 80s, some of that kind of stuff where you've just got early synths blending with vocals, just that kind of stuff. And some of the recordings of that and the techniques and the bands around then. And there's some good stuff out there. Things I come to hate is like, is exactly as AD's pointing out, the Stock Aitken and Waterman stuff, the early stuff I could cope with, but the stuff that's coming out now is just literally mind chewing gum. And then, like you say, the Sam Foxy stuff, where it's been people being exploited, but that seems to be the music industry. And then Shaking Stevens and all the rest of it. And there's so many naff 80s bands as well, like really bad hair metal bands that are just, you don't realize how naff they are until, you know, there's good ones, everyone knows the good ones, but there's all the other also rans, there's so many.
And also the volume of blandcore.
I didn't realize that there was even that much, but I wouldn't have listened to it back then, you know. No.
It's musical wallpaper, it's just,
Well, yeah, so the thing to remember here, really, is that it's about the accessibility of music. I couldn't afford to go and buy records and CDs. This is what I heard on the radio back then. You know, that was it. And what I recorded on tape was what I recorded off the charts that was on every Sunday. That was it. So, and I picked and chose what I had. And, you know, I had the most eclectic music taste of anyone I can think of back then. Anyway, I'd go from listening to some Elvis Presley to listen to Golden Brown by the Stranglers. So I just, you know, I just liked what I liked by what I heard. And also I had an older brother and two older sisters who also listened to a lot of music. So I kind of like what they liked. And so, you know, I heard a lot of punk when I was young because my brother was a punk. I heard a lot of David Bowie and stuff because my sister was massively into David Bowie. I heard a lot of Elvis because my sister was massively into Elvis. So my taste aligned with what they were listening to at that time. But have I enjoyed revisiting the music for the podcast? Yes. But I didn't realize how much blandcore there was, which is loads. I didn't realize how much one hit wonders in the UK. It's unbelievable how many there are.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And sometimes, you know, they're not even one hit wonders. They're not hit wonders. So they don't hit, but they're still there, sort of stinging you like a bee. And there's a few of them. So yeah, it's been a journey, all right, that.
Yeah. And final question, when is the next Coronation Street song coming up? And why is it your favourite TV show?
It's not my favourite TV show. It's just, you know what? It's because it's been going that long. It has been going on TV my whole life.
Yeah, it's a cultural institution. It's always been with us. It just is what it is.
It's like that Christmas song by Noddy Holder and Slade, you know, so here it is, Merry Christmas. Yeah, that came out in 1973. That's the year I was born. So there's never been a year of my life where that hasn't been on at Christmas, ever.
Yeah.
And the same with Coronation Street. It's been going since 1962, is it?
Something like
So it's, there's never been a week in my life where there hasn't been an episode of Coronation Street on one way or another, ever.
Yeah.
So it's not my favourite. It's just the most ubiquitous, I think. And also, there's characters in there we can readily pick on, including, obviously, the Barlows and the things like that. Yeah. So
the Barlows and the Baldwins.
Well, the sad thing is, a lot of these characters, and not just the characters, the people who played them have passed away.
Yeah.
So your Percy Sugden, he's dead. Phyllis, dead. You know, Mac Baldwin, dead. Deirdre Barlow, dead.
Yeah, Fred. What's his face? Died the other day,
recently,
didn't he?
Yeah, Fred. I say Fred. Yeah, he's dead. Yeah.
That guy. I say.
Yeah, Betty Turpin.
It's Foghorn Leghorn, isn't he?
Yeah. Betty Turpin, dead. Choked on her own shepherd's pie, I heard. Bette Lynch, dead. Wilmer?
This is like
Elmer,
starting to get like
the
Spinal Tap commentary. He's dead. Died.
You know, that's why it's not our favourite. It's just never been out of our
weekly
purview. It's always been there.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Manco asks, what are you doing after you reach the final issue of Zap 64? More podcasts? Maybe, probably. Don't know.
Yeah, there'll be something. There'll be something, I'm sure. Something.
I mean, we've still got 2 years worth of stuff.
Exactly. I was going to say, it's quite a way off yet.
Yeah, so we don't have to worry about it just yet. Yeah. As Gary pointed out, Lee Dove, name two times, Zap Review swayed you into buying a game you had no interest in previously with the following results. You were chuffed with your purchase. You were full of regret. Chuffed with your purchase. Well, I can do one that I know off the top of my head. That would be Leaderboard.
Yeah, I never bought that, but I could see where you'd be chuffed with that.
Yeah, because I didn't. Who's going to buy a golf game? I live on a council estate in Grimsby. Why would I play a golf game? And then I did because they gave it a gold medal and it was ace. So there's that. I don't know. Another one. Full of regret. Gary. This is. I'm going to go for Gary here. But I remember Gary buying Mercenary. Based solely on the Zap Review, and he hated it.
I can imagine not liking that.
Yeah. And I remember him getting Paradroid as well, and we were very chuffed with that purchase. What about yourself? Yeah. What about you? You got any?
But Zap persuaded me, and I regretted Gauntlet.
Yeah.
I bought Gauntlet and the Deeper Dungeons, and I did regret that. Because it wasn't as I imagined it would be. I think maybe Zap did tip their hand a little bit of that. And games that Zap sort of influenced and, you know, I was chuffed to bits with. That's a bit more difficult, that, because Zap never really influenced me because I already kind of knew about the games. What influence do they have? I think, if I was honest, Last Ninja, because they had that demo on their cover tape.
Yes.
And that kind of sealed the deal. I mean, I'd already sort of got wind of something about it and I had not seen it, but once I saw that, that swayed me into buying that game without a doubt. I was like, I'm having that. I've got to have it. And then when it came out, I was chuffed to bits with it and still am. So, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. And our final question from Gary. What's your top three comedy films of all freaking time?
Oh, God's sake. Why is he in with top threes?
It's because he does things in threes. He goes to the toilet in threes.
I hate to think about. I don't want to think about that.
He has three rounds of bread for his sandwiches. He's a weirdo.
He uses three sheets of toilet paper.
Yeah, one for down and one to polish.
One for each hole.
He's like a bowling ball. Down.
God's sake. I've lost all rational thought has escaped my mind. That's the most horrific thing you've ever said. Down below Gary's like a bowling ball. I can't unsee that now. I'm a visual person.
Top three comedy films, I don't know. Airplane, Top Secret, Naked Gun, I'd Be Happy, Amazon Women on the Moon, I don't know.
I'd got Amazon Women on the Moon, I'd put in there, I think, because that always makes me laugh.
Yeah.
But it's a top for me. I'm not, these aren't the top films of all time. They're just, you know, my top three. So definitely Amazon Women on the Moon. I'm trying to think of films that have actually had me really laughing.
Maybe I'm going to get you Sucker in there. always makes me laugh.
No, oh, it's so difficult. No, not for me. I mean, it's a funny film, but it's not in my top three.
It's so quotable.
It is, but it's just.
But I think the three
it's,
I said.
It's difficult.
I think Naked Gun, Airplane, and Top Secret. They're just.
Yeah, I've put maybe I won't have all of them in there. Maybe Top Secret actually, because out of all of those ones, that's the one that always had me properly stupidly laughing. And then to put a more sort of a more modernised one in, that's really difficult. No, because it could be Man with Two Brains, because I think that's really funny.
Oh, yeah.
It could be Spinal Tap, because I think that's hilarious.
Oh, yeah, Spinal Tap. How did I forget Spinal Tap?
So there's just too many. I couldn't pick a three, but yeah. No, I've listed some out there, and there's a few out there that I put in there. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I think it's really good. Dumb and Dumber makes me laugh. there's loads of stupid films out there like that kind of, and that's kind of the, you know, I like clever humour, but I also like just sort of stupid humour. I'd like the clever humour when, and the combination of those. I'm not a big fan of the sort of the later ones, you know, the sort of, not the Naked Gun ones, because they're really good, but the sort of offshoot ones, you know.
Oh,
the,
Spy
the sort
of Hard Mickey, and Dracula Dead and Loving It and stuff. They were rubbish.
Yeah, and then all the other ones as well. Scary sort of Rambo Mickey takes with thingy in and that sort of thing.
Oh,
yeah,
Hot Shots.
I don't like Scary Movie. Yeah, and Hot Shots and stuff. Like, they're all right, but they're not going to, no, they're not hilarious for me. But, you know, there are some, you know, other classic ones out there, aren't there? I don't know. There's a lot of comedy films out there in the world that, you know, my tastes are quite weird about things like that. You know, I mean, I like what I like.
I might even put Ghostbusters in there.
Yeah, Ghostbusters has its place. I suppose it's kind of a cheeky laugh, you know. It does make you laugh here and there, doesn't it? I think sometimes what the factors are that make them really funny. Is it the comedy itself? Is it the fact that you can sort of regale them and quote them to each other?
Would you have Caddyshack in there?
See, I really like Caddyshack, but again, it's because of the stupid moments in it that make me laugh.
Exactly.
But, you know, they might not make everybody laugh, but, you know, I like those sort of silly characters.
It also has the quickest "I'm pregnant, I'm not pregnant" subplot of any film ever.
Exactly, and that's part of the comedy of that film is that it's badly put together as well, and it's Harold Ramis. It's just crazy.
Yeah. But that's it.
Anyway,
there you go.
That's it.
That's the questions. We have been asked them. We have answered them. This is what we do. So I hope you've enjoyed that. That's been good fun. I always like to answer the questions and some good stuff in there, some good questions. We will be back next week where we'll be getting back to February. So we'll be starting February 1990. So there you go. Hope you've enjoyed that. As ever, I have been Graham. Sorry, I've not been Graham Raddings. I've been two Ronnies.
No, you haven't.
As ever. You've been, as ever, I've been Adrian Mills.
And I've been Graham Raddings, I think.
And you've been listening to the special Ask the Podcast of Zap to the Past. We'll see you again next week. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Zap to the Past podcast. We hope you enjoyed our deep dive into the world of Commodore 64 games, as well as the music, films, and TV from around the 1980s, driven, of course, by the issue of Zap 64 magazine published at that time. We will return with a whole new batch of games and stuff to talk about next week. Until then, if you want to listen to or download previous episodes of Zap to the Past, and why wouldn't you, they can all be found on our website at zaptothepast.com, as well as being available on Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, Audible, Player FM, and, well, pretty much anywhere where we can upload them. By the way, we do always love to hear from our amazing listeners, so if you'd like to contact us about anything in the podcast or beyond, you can do so by emailing us at zaptothepast@gmail.com. We're also active on Twitter under @ZapToThe, as well as Facebook, Instagram, and most social media platforms. Just search for Zap to the Past and you'll find us. Oh, and if you like the podcast and what we're doing, please do like, share, review, rate us. It really helps. Something, apparently. The Zap to the Past podcast is written and produced by Adrian Mills and Graham Raddings and recorded at Flaky Bits 2.0 Studio. All opinions expressed are those of the writers, and while we indeed love Zap 64 magazine, the Zap to the Past podcast is not affiliated with it in any way. Stay safe, see you next time, and remember, we play these games so you don't have to.